Welcome to episode 256 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com here for Sunday, January 20th, 2013. I am the Solomonster. Hope everybody's having a great week. We got a lot to get to here this week. We have a 20th anniversary edition of Raw to talk about and a big wedding on Impact this past Thursday night that I thought was actually quite entertaining. So we'll get to all that. First, let's start out with Raw. This past Monday night, emanating from Houston, Texas, the 20th anniversary edition of Monday Night Raw. You know, I still remember my first edition of Monday Night Raw from home, because we didn't have cable until much later on. That didn't come until after the Survivor Series in 1995, which was actually my very first pay-per-view from home at the time. I, of course, have seen editions of Raw from before then. I had, you know, relatives and friends tape them for me, and I would watch them. But that's, you know, as far back as I date being able to watch Raw from home, it goes back to 95, and it was a big deal back then once we got cable and we were able to watch those shows, because up until that point, it was all Superstars and Wrestling Challenge and all of the syndicated programming, so that was a big deal. And Raw obviously has grown by leaps and bounds. It's become a much bigger show over the years, and syndicated programming has fallen to the wayside. That was from a different time, a different era. And it was cool seeing all the Raw intros. I mean, we've seen this before on some of the other landmark editions of Raw. They show the old show opens from back in the day and stuff. And to me, that never gets old. There's been a lot of good ones. And so that was always a treat to be able to see that. I thought as a normal standard edition of Raw, show was fine. I see quite a bit of hate being directed towards it. People very disappointed and whatnot. You know, it had some star power to it. It had Rock, Foley, Flair. But I think maybe we've all been spoiled by shows like Raw 1000 and the Slammies, where they trot out a bunch of older faces for cameos and that sort of thing, because we had very little of that on this show, and I think people were expecting more. And that's where some of the disappointment, I think, comes from. I just think our expectations may have been a little too high. You know, WWE never actually announced that they were bringing back guys like Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. We all just assumed that they would be there, either because, you know, Austin missed Raw 1000 because of a knee injury, and so we figured, well, they're in Texas for the 20th anniversary show. Surely the biggest star in Raw history will be there, and he wasn't. Same for Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, who both live in Texas. Apparently Austin and Michaels were out in Las Vegas at a gun show. They had a previous commitment, and Undertaker was off repossessing souls, I guess, and doing whatever it is that Undertakers do. So, really, WWE isn't so much to blame for this. We are. We set our expectations a little too high, and I think if you were left unfulfilled, again, it's because you were expecting something that you were never promised. That's kind of what I told myself when the show was over. You know, unlike another wrestling company that blatantly false advertises something for months that they know they can't deliver. Yeah, that's quite the story. I'm going to get to that a little bit later on in the podcast. But let's just go over some of the key events from Raw Monday night. The Rock, of course, involved in the main event segment, the Rock Concert. Started around 11 o'clock, and I mentioned that. It's kind of interesting to me that they have a three-hour show. And I'm looking at the clock thinking to myself, God, you know, either this is going to be the shortest concert that we've ever seen, or this show is going to end up being 3.5 hours long. And it wasn't quite 3.5 hours long, but I don't quite understand why you have to kind of go overtime when you've already got 3 hours. I mean, it made sense when the show was 2 hours. You'd go over by 5, 10, 15 minutes. I just don't think that's really necessary now, especially for the people who, you know, have had their fill. I mean, my God, 3 hours is it's more than enough. But Rock was out there with his guitar, and the fans were into it. Fans loved this. He sang some songs, sang a song about Vicky Guerrero, in fact, and was complimenting her, and she was on stage kind of blushing and smiling, and of course that didn't last very long. Rock was insulting her. She she turned very sour very quickly. She was not very happy with this. And basically Rock said that she did not look good, and she was, I think, a biatch or something, and then she ended up leaving. And look, I mean, for what it was pretty much what I thought it was going to be. It was Rock's, you know, over-the-top form of comedy here. There's certain things that he does when he's out there. He talks about, you know, Paul Heyman having Twinkie tits and that sort of thing. And, I mean, me personally, I'm kind of over that. That doesn't really, it doesn't really do much for me. I don't know if I'm just more mature. I would hope I'm more mature than I was, you know, 10 years ago when he used to do that sort of thing. I don't really think he has to do that, quite frankly, to stoop that low, but whatever. I mean, it's Rock. It's what he does. And who am I to argue? The fans were into it, although they did not start a Twinkie Tits chant, so I don't believe that was trending on Twitter at any point. But you know, Punk came out with Heyman towards the end of the segment. They had a back and forth, you know, verbal duel, if you will, and then eventually Punk came down. There was a pull apart brawl between Rock and Punk, kind of a weak one to me. I don't know, you know, Rock just, and I don't want to blame Rock necessarily, but there didn't seem to be as much fire, perhaps, as there should have been in this sort of pull-apart brawl. Sometimes you have the babyface who is being restrained by officials, and then they break free, and they jump through the air, and they launch themselves at the heel. If anything, I think it was Punk, if I remember correctly, who kind of broke free and launched himself at the Rock. So, not the best pull-apart brawl I've ever seen before, but nonetheless, you know, it was fine for what it is. Nice little way to advance things as we approach Rock vs. Punk at the Royal Rumble. And I guess, look, the segment served its purpose. I don't need to see Rock out there doing a concert. You know, to me, I think there are better ways to promote what is going to be a huge title match. I mean, this is a big deal. You know, Rock vs. Punk should be a special match. I feel it is. You know, Rock and Punk for the WWE Championship. Some people say that this should be the WrestleMania main event. I don't know that I agree with that. But this match has to be a big deal because you've got a big star like The Rock in there against CM Punk, who's been champion now for 400 and something days. Like I said, I'm looking forward to the match, but I didn't necessarily need to see Rock out there, you know, cracking jokes on Vicky Guerrero. I think they could come up with something a little bit better. But that was the big angle to close the show. The main event on the show infuriated me. The main event was a steel cage match between Dolph Ziggler and John Cena. Now, this is the same cage match that I saw several weeks back on the holiday tour when WWE came to Madison Square Garden. You'll recall I gave my review of that show, and I thought the cage match on that show was very, very good. It was easily the match of the night. And to be fair, this was not a bad cage match. This was actually a pretty good match, largely, I think, because of Dolph Ziggler, but I'll give John Cena his just due as well. It's a very good main event, but like I said, it left me infuriated, and it left me infuriated for the same reason that I was angry about the last John Cena-Dolph Ziggler match that we saw. Now, keep in mind, Ziggler beat Cena at TLC. I was at that show. That was a great match, and that was a great conclusion. The AJ turn, Ziggler retrieves the briefcase, the crowd goes crazy. Most of the fans were already cheering for Dolph Ziggler anyway. And as far as Dolph Ziggler is concerned, it appears as though he may be going babyface very soon. Which is funny because, again, Big Show had done that radio interview here in New York last month when he was in town to promote TLC. He had a sit-down interview with Peter Rosenberg, which is up on YouTube. Very good interview. And he specifically talked, he was very open, very honest, talked about Dolph Ziggler and how he and a lot of the other veterans wanted to see him start using the super kick as a finisher because it's over. It's an over move, thanks in large part to Shawn Michaels. And Ziggler pulls off one hell of a super kick. Dare I say he does it better than Shawn Michaels. I don't want to go that far, but he does a hell of a job with it. And it wasn't very long after that we started seeing Ziggler use that as his finish. Although I don't think he's actually beaten anybody with it yet, except I guess he beat Randy Orton with it back at Survivor Series. But since then, I don't know that he's won a match with it. But all of a sudden, Ziggler started using the super kick. And the other thing Big Show mentioned in that interview was that they think the sky is the limit for Ziggler with that super kick as a finish, but as a babyface, not as a heel. So clearly, I don't know where Vince McMahon stands on this spectrum, but clearly Big Show and others in the company feel that's really where Ziggler's future lies. It is as a babyface, not as a bad guy. And we've seen some hints on television lately of some dissension in the ranks with Big E Langston, you know, like a couple weeks ago. First Raw of 2013 opened with Ziggler versus Cena because Langston accepted the match on Ziggler's behalf, and they were teasing, oh, Ziggler wasn't very happy about that. And, of course, Ziggler lost that match, which also didn't sit well with me. Because my logic is this. Dolph Ziggler is the future of the company. Whether he's going to be the number one guy, the number two guy, I think people realize that this guy's going to be a big star. And he's the kind of star who perhaps could carry the company at some point. So you want to do everything in your power to kind of get him over to that next level. He needs all the help he can get. Because last year, for all the great matches he had, I believe he lost more matches than anybody else on the roster. And God knows, every time he was in the ring with Sheamus, he ate a brogue kick for lunch. You know, it's his favorite meal, apparently, because he ate so many brogue kicks from Sheamus and lost so many matches last year, it became comical after a while. And so the win at TLC was a big deal. You know, it validated him. I said that, you know, winning the briefcase, which is essentially what he did, he basically won it a second time, at that pay-per-view was a bigger win than the initial Money in the Bank win. It meant more. He was the last man standing at the end of that pay-per-view with a fallen John Cena at his feet down below. And so you come back on the first Raw of 2013, you got a lot more eyeballs watching Raw than you did that pay-per-view. And John Cena beats him. Now, it wasn't just that John Cena beat him. I understand John Cena's the top dog. John Cena's probably going to headline WrestleMania with The Rock. John Cena had a horrible 2012. He's vowed to have a much better 2013. That's the story. I get that. But was it really necessary that week, that first week on Raw this year, in that match, to have Ziggler use every single move in his arsenal and have Cena kick out of it like it was nothing? He used the zigzag, he used the super kick, I mean, he used the Famouser, everything. Langston interfered, Langston laid Cena out with his finishing move, Cena kicked out of everything. And then one attitude adjustment later and the match was over. And that pissed me off. So then they come back this week and they have this match. And again, I hate to berate the match because it was a really good match. But yet again, John Cena is kicking out of everything. I tweeted at one point, I said Ziggler's all out of moves. Because he was. What was left for him to do in that match? There was a spot in that cage match where Cena is about to go out the door. And Langston slams the door into Cena's head. That's pretty heavy stuff right there. That's a finishing spot right there. And Langston is no slouch. I mean, Langston, people say that, you know, John Cena is one of the strongest men in WWE, and he is, and so is, you know, Antonio Cesaro. These are very powerful men. Perhaps none more so than Langston. Langston's a power lifter. They've talked about his accomplishments and how he lifts or he benches like 500, 600, 700 pounds. He's a big, strong dude. This is not me slamming a door on John Cena's head. This is Big E Langston slamming a door on Cena's head after he's wrestled an exhaustive cage match against the Money in the Bank winner. And he kicks out. And that was the spot, I think, that just made me throw my hands in the air and go, oh, this is just ridiculous. Because, I mean, people joke about John Cena being booked as Superman. And I get that. He is Superman. He is the number one guy in the company. Fine. But at what point do you just sit there and go, okay, this is ridiculous? And I reached that point in this match. And it ruined my enjoyment of the match. It took me out of the match. Because at that point I knew there was nothing that Dolph Ziggler could do to win this match. So what's the point? And again, they teased dissension. Langston was in the cage. He ended up getting nailed by accident with the briefcase. In the end, John Cena wins. Of course, John Cena wins. So 2 weeks in a row now. On television, John Cena has been victorious over Dolph Ziggler. And that Money in the Bank, essentially, ladder match, which is what it was at TLC, is a distant memory at this point. And Ziggler will go on, I'm sure, to cash in at some point and win the championship. I don't know that he'll do it at the Rumble, but it'll happen at some point. And he'll be the champ. But stuff like this does him no good. So that irritated me. That pissed me off more than anything else on this entire show. Because there's a way to do this match where John Cena does not have to kick out of every single move this guy has. What does this guy have to do? Does he have to drop an anvil on John Cena's head? like in a Roadrunner cartoon? Does he have to set, you know, C4 dynamite in his trunks? I mean, what does he have to do? Anyway, some of the other stuff on this show. The other thing, actually, was the Divas match. Divas match on this show went 5 minutes, 27 seconds, according to my trusty Divas stopwatch, which is pretty good. And Caitlin, in her hometown of Houston, beat Eve to become the new Divas champion. And news broke earlier that day that Eve was wrestling her final match in WWE. That was going to be it for her. She was it was her final night with the company. She was leaving to go do other things. She's getting married soon. And so Eve is done with WWE. And I was very sad to hear that. Obviously, Eve has come a long way since the beginning, and she was very good in her role and very attractive. And as an in-ring competitor, I think she really upped her game over the last few years and had a pretty good run as the champion, actually multiple-time Divas champion. So clearly they're passing the torch now to Caitlin. And supposedly, as this story goes, this match was originally booked for the Royal Rumble. And Eve wanted to give Caitlin a win in her hometown, which is a rare thing, of course, in WWE. Not too many people get to win in their hometown. And so Eve did her a solid, basically, and Caitlin went over. And it was a big night for Caitlin. But what does it say about the Divas division that yet another big name is now gone? And again, it doesn't sound like Eve is leaving because she's unhappy or anything like that. But still, Eve was essentially the biggest star that they had in that division. AJ Lee is a bigger female star, probably more than anybody else in the company, but she's not really a wrestler so much as she is a personality. You know, she's a manager now. Where does this leave the Divas division? Now, I said on the Sound Off a couple of weeks back when I did my year in review show and the prediction show that my big bold prediction for 2013 is that the Divas division at some point this year will go away. As we know it, the Divas division will come to an end because it's been neglected for so long and there's been so many Divas that have left the company. And Eve maybe now is the biggest name of all. You know, Beth Phoenix was another one. You know, the Bellas left, among others. But there are other reports now that suggest that WWE may be interested in reviving the old Diva Search, which actually Eve won the Diva Search back in 2007. She had been a dancer with no formal wrestling training, and she went on to become a pretty damn good worker. So there's always hope with these things. But, you know, apparently they're looking for women 18 to 30 years old, pretty faces, great bodies, and of course, no wrestling experience is required. So, who knows? Maybe they find one or two new stars out of it, like they did with Eve. Although, if they have no wrestling experience like Eve didn't, you know, they sent her down to developmental, and it was years before she improved to any real noticeable degree. Like I said, right now, AJ is the most popular diva, and she's not wrestling as much as she is managing, and probably servicing all of the men on the roster. They're going to try to make Caitlin the next big thing, and she's gotten better. You know, she is very pretty, but they need other people. That's not enough. Who's she going to work with? I mean, Natalya's been turned babyface and heel so many times. Now she's a babyface with Hornswoggle and the Great Khali. I mean, I guess they could turn her heel again if they wanted somebody really good for Caitlin to work with. But, you know, if they insist on doing a diva search, that's fine. But why not also sign one or two other talented female performers to boost the division until you find that next big star? Yeah, they've got one under contract right now, working down in NXT as a trainer. Sara Del Rey. They even let her keep that name. Why not? What do you have to lose? Because to me, that's the only hope the Divas division has at this point. We also had a match on this show. It was Wade Barrett and Randy Orton. Non-title, of course. This, to me, was the biggest shocker of, not just Raw, but probably the biggest shocker of the week. And it shouldn't be, because if rumor is to be believed, Randy Orton may be going heel very soon. That has certainly been the belief. And Orton has made no bones about the fact, when people have asked him on Twitter before, you know, which role do you prefer to play? Randy Orton likes being the bad guy. And if I were a betting man, I'd say sometime between now and WrestleMania, Randy Orton is going to go back to the dark side. And so typically when that happens, you can lose. You know, you can lose as many matches as you want to if you're about to do a major turn like that. And that's what we had on this show. Randy Orton got beat clean in the middle of the ring by Wade Barrett with his bullhammer elbow. There was no hooking of the tights. There was no low blow. There was no rake to the eyes. There was no foreign object. It was just a clean win by the Intercontinental Champion over one of the biggest stars in the company. And I know Orton hasn't exactly been treated like one of the biggest stars in the company all year, but still, people look at Randy Orton and they see him as a top guy. And for Wade Barrett to get a clean win over Randy Orton like that, that's a big deal. I was stunned when I saw the finish of that match. And it made me wonder, again, you know, that's how you put somebody over. I was very impressed. That was a big credibility boost, in my opinion, for Wade Barrett. Why can't Cena do that for Ziggler? Is it really going to hurt John Cena to lose a match like that to Dolph Ziggler? One match? So I was stunned when this match was over, and in a pleasant way. I was very happy. I was pleasantly surprised to see Wade Barrett get that kind of win over Randy Orton on this show. The show opened, actually, with a segment with Big Show, Vince McMahon. Alberto Del Rio came out. Of course, he is the new World Heavyweight Champion. They basically, the point of this segment was to set up a rematch between the two for the Royal Rumble. So that is where we will get the Big Show Del Rio rematch for the championship on that show. The one thing that struck me here is that, you know, Big Show was being very complimentary of Vince McMahon at the beginning and basically sucking up to him and kissing his rear end. And it made, you know, Vince McMahon at one point said, "Don't call me Vince, you know, call me Mr. McMahon." And Big Show was, you know, "Oh, okay, sir, I'm sorry." You know, the guy's got an ironclad contract. Whatever happened to that contract? Remember that when Big Johnny re-signed Big Show and Big Show went on TV saying, "Listen, I've got an ironclad contract. I can't be fired. I can't be punished. I could do whatever I want." And all of a sudden he's kissing Vince McMahon's ass like he's worried that he's going to get fired. So anyway, that's one of those little inconsistencies there. We had a segment on this show also. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about this. The Miz had a Miz TV segment with the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. There had been rumors and murmurs that Flair was going to be on the show doing some sort of angle with CM Punk. I believe Flair is going to be on Raw again this week and possibly SmackDown, so it's possible he can do something on those shows with Punk. But he didn't interact with Punk at all on this show. Instead, what they did was they decided they were going to essentially have Ric Flair, one of the greatest, if not the greatest wrestler of all time, at least of this modern generation, put The Miz over and essentially endorse The Miz and pass the torch to him and try to help. Because God knows Miz needs all the help he can get. Miz has been a terrible babyface, just absolutely horrendous. And he's also a pretty bad announcer, in my opinion, on Main Event. But that's what the purpose of this segment was. But I was more shocked. Talk about shocks. I was more shocked these guys actually sat down during the segment. They didn't sit on the couch, but they both actually sat down in their respective chairs. That's something you just don't see in these Miz TV or any wrestler talk show segments anymore. So just them sitting down blew me away. They went back and forth. They were wooing with one another. Antonio Cesaro came out because he's in the middle of a feud with Miz over the U.S. title. And, you know, of course, he insulted both men, went to walk away. Flair gave him some chops. They beat him up a little bit. Flair went to go give Cesaro the figure four leg lock. Then he stopped and he allowed Miz. He gave Miz the honor of putting the figure four on Antonio Cesaro. And apparently, the idea here is that Miz is going to start using the figure four leg lock as his new finisher. At least according to the latest Observer newsletter, that is going to be The Miz's new finishing maneuver. He actually beat Primo with it on SmackDown Friday night. And I hate the skull-crushing finale, so I actually have no problem with this. The figure four is a move that really hurts. Take my word for it. I've had it applied to me before. It's a move that really hurts. It looks like it really hurts. Unlike the skull-crushing finale. I rail on some guys for having really shitty finishing maneuvers. And Miz didn't have the worst, you know, and there were times where, listen, the skull-crushing finale, the whole point of the move is you're dropping down, right? You're ramming the guy's face first down into the mat. In theory, that hurts. If somebody rammed my face into the floor, you know, if it didn't break my nose, it would probably hurt. But most of the time when I see this move, you know, executed on TV, it doesn't exactly look devastating. So if that is the end of the skull-crushing finale, or if it becomes a setup move to the figure four, I'm perfectly okay with that. What I wonder is if they actually believe that just by virtue of Ric Flair endorsing The Miz or hanging out with The Miz, if they think that's going to be enough to get him over. Hey, I give them points for trying. This Miz Babyface thing ain't working. So who knows? Maybe hanging out with Ric Flair will help him. I don't know if the idea is for him to kind of be the Ric Flair of this generation. I laugh uproariously at that idea. That will never happen. But they've certainly, in my opinion, bungled this Miz Babyface turn. I don't even know that Miz should be a babyface, quite frankly, but maybe this will help him. Maybe this will actually help him. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with that. The other thing I wanted to mention here, by the way, just as an aside, TNA filed a motion earlier this past week to dismiss its ongoing lawsuit against WWE, the one they filed for tampering after Flair left the company last year, or was fired, depending on who you believe. So if there was any hesitation on WWE's part in bringing any current or any former TNA talent into the company after what Jerry McDevitt had told the court about them not being interested in signing anyone from TNA, apparently they're now free to do whatever they want. So I'm not saying there will suddenly be an influx of old TNA talent. I know at one time WWE had interest in Alex Shelley, for example, and they may still. Perhaps now it makes it a little bit easier for them to bring people like him in. But it also makes me think of Matt Morgan. It makes me think of Velvet Sky, people who had left TNA this past year for a certain period of time. There were rumors that they were interested, potentially, in joining WWE. And one of the reasons, at least, if not the reason, that they were not able to was because of this lawsuit. And so they ended up re-signing with TNA. You know, if they really did have any interest in going over to WWE, sucks for them that they didn't wait it out a little bit more. But, you know, with something like this, this lawsuit could have gone on for years. I mean, there's no telling how long something like this could go on for. But thankfully, now that is over. That is put to bed. People can go wherever they want to go. And so I just wanted to point that out. Let the record show that on this show, Heath Slater beat Sheamus in a match. Granted, it was an over-the-top rope challenge, and his fellow 3MB bandmates assisted with eliminating Sheamus. But nonetheless, the record book will show that Heath Slater beat Sheamus, even though all three of them ate brogue kicks when the match was over. So I guess aside from Wade Barrett beating Randy Orton clean, perhaps this would have been, I guess, the biggest surprise to me on this show. And the last thing I'll mention here is Mick Foley was on the show. There were people who wrote into me, who emailed me, very upset with how Foley was treated. He was out there basically as the first inductee into the WWE Hall of Fame. And that had been announced earlier, actually in the week. The news had leaked. And so pretty much everybody already knew he was the first inductee. He came out, got a nice ovation. Didn't really get to talk very much before The Shield came out. And The Shield were about to pounce on Mick Foley. Sheamus ran out. Randy Orton ran out. Eventually, Ryback came out, cleared house. And Ryback actually cut a promo afterwards. Foley just kind of disappeared. Aside from a backstage segment he had with The Rock, which was very entertaining, he disappeared. And Ryback cut a promo in the ring. Josh Matthews was interviewing him, and he basically says, "Feed me Shield. Ryback wants the Shield." So I guess that match will be coming up soon. But they were, you know, people were upset that Foley didn't have a chance to talk. It was kind of, his appearance left a lot to be desired. They didn't show him the proper amount of respect that he deserved. The guy's going into the Hall of Fame in Madison Square Garden. How much more respect can you show the guy? You know, people were upset they didn't show a video. They probably feel pretty stupid now, being that they actually did show a video. I believe the video was on SmackDown this week. But it's certainly up online on WWE.com. They have a very nice video package that they put together for Foley. So people who are upset can calm down, okay? Again, the guy is going into the Hall of Fame, and people are still complaining that they don't show him any respect. Just take it easy. Calm down. Quick follow-up on a note that I had in the show last week regarding Kazuchika Okada of New Japan Pro Wrestling. There had been a lot of rumor that WWE was interested. They had him on their radar, and he had actually lost in the main event of their big Tokyo Dome iPay-per-view show a couple weeks back. He lost, Okada did, in the main event to Hiroshi Tanahashi, which only fueled the flames of people thinking that he was on his way out. And apparently, that is not the case. Okada has rejected the chance to possibly join WWE. Again, I don't know that an offer was ever made, but he has essentially cast them aside and has signed a new contract with New Japan. And Okada was not happy with all the rumors that were going around. Many people were worried that he was going to bolt. And he told Tokyo Sports that he is going nowhere and renewed his New Japan contract. So that is obviously good news for New Japan. Okada is a big star over there. Really had a star-making year in 2012, and it would have been a big blow to lose him. And apparently that is not something that they have to worry about now. So WWE's loss is New Japan's gain. I guess we'll have to wait a little bit longer to get that Yoshitatsu Kazuchika Okada tag team in WWE. Impact Wrestling from Thursday night. We had a wedding on the show, and all of us were invited. I didn't even have a tuxedo on. I feel like a schlub. We were all invited to the wedding. I enjoyed it. I really did. I think the Billy and Chuck wedding angle on SmackDown years ago, probably about 10 years ago now, is still my favorite. You know, the Bischoff Priest reveal was just so incredibly well done during that angle. It was great. And if Bischoff were to be revealed eventually as the leader of Aces and Eights, which I would rather not see, but if that were to happen, then they should have done the same thing here. Just put the makeup on him, the prosthetics, do it all over again, only this time with Aces and Eights running out instead of Jamal and Rosie. That would have been a nice little wink and a nod to that wedding angle from years back on SmackDown. But I really enjoyed the way they played the wedding up throughout the entire show. They showed Bully Ray backstage with his groomsmen, you know, little Spike Dudley, who looks 20 years older than the last time I saw him. I believe he's a school teacher now. And Tommy Dreamer, fresh off an appearance on Monday Night Raw only last month. I guess that makes him the closest thing to the Rick Rude of this generation, only not really. I like the wedding stuff largely because it made the show feel special. It did not feel like your normal run-of-the-mill edition of Impact to me. From those first segments on the show where they show Bully backstage with Dreamer and Spike, and then they go and they show Brooke Hogan having her makeup done and all the knockouts are dressed up, Miss Tessmacher looks smoking hot. It felt different, and that's a good thing. Plus, they obviously wanted to help pop a big number leading into the debut of Bellator at 10 p.m., which they did. Impact did very well on Thursday night, and most of the wrestling fans who watched proceeded to bail once Bellator hit the airwaves, so sucks for Bellator. Let's go through the show here. Jeff Hardy and James Storm, they opened the show with a win over Bad Influence, and if you guessed that Daniels and Kazarian won, well, silly you. If you guessed that Daniels was the one to take the fall, you're not very good with this game, are you? Of course, Kazarian took the losing fall to Hardy, as he always does. Hardy was attacked after the match by Daniels. Daniels is challenging him for the World Heavyweight title on this upcoming week's edition of Impact, which has already been taped. And I have not looked at the results, but, and this is a spoiler alert, so if you don't want to know anything at all, skip ahead by 20 seconds. I do know they did some sort of injury angle on the show with Jeff Hardy to explain his absence from the upcoming UK tour. And I'm going to have something to say about that in a few minutes. So you can look forward to that. There was a fantastic backstage segment on this show where Joseph Park walks into Bully Ray's dressing room to wish him good luck with his nuptials, despite their rocky past together. Remember, these are two men that feuded. They had a blood feud over what happened to, you know, Joe Park's brother Abyss, and they had some matches. And in spite of all of that history, Joe Park was kind enough and professional enough to come in and wish him luck. He also gave Bully Ray a box of Cuban cigars, and he cautioned him to keep it on the down low, given that they are not street legal. Need to keep that kayfabe, he says. Not sure how smart it is for an attorney to be admitting to such a thing with a camera in the room, but hey, you know. Then he asked Bully about having a prenup before he leaves. Bully tells him to get out. I've said it before. I will continue to say it as long as it's true. Joe Park is my favorite character in all of wrestling right now. Just the absolute best. Jay Bradley and Brian Cage came out to face the gut check judges after their match last week. Cage got dismissed immediately, which left Jay Bradley to find out if he was getting a contract or not. Taz said no. Al Snow and Bruce Pritchard both said yes, so Bradley and his boomstick are officially in the company now. Austin Aries and Bobby Roode were both backstage talking about crashing the wedding and how they've been carrying the company on their backs for the past year. He says, why do Bully and Brooke get a celebration? We should be the ones getting a celebration. He's right. Makes a very good point. Obviously, it's a step down from competing for the world title, but I happen to like this pairing so far. I have been very entertained by Aries and Rude. In many ways, it mirrors the pairing of Kane and Daniel Bryan, in that you have these two former world champions, you know, main event guys, pairing off, who really don't like one another. But they've been united by some sort of common bond, some sort of common cause. There's been comedy with it, but so far it's not an excessive amount of comedy. I find them very entertaining. And you know, with Daniels and Kazarian already there doing their thing, I don't know if you need this, but, you know, what else is there for them to do right now? Jeff Hardy needs to move on to the next feud. He can't keep wrestling the same guys for the title over and over again. So I like this combo. I wouldn't mind seeing them as the, you know, get the tag team straps from Chavo and Hernandez, who I find to be just incredibly boring. And speaking of Chavo, I have to mention this. Was I the only one who caught that graphic TNA put up on the screen plugging the lockdown tickets going on sale for the Alamo Dome? And they had names. They had little graphics on the bottom for Sting, I think, and Jeff Hardy. They may have also had Hulk Hogan. And there's Chavo Guerrero next to those guys. Really? Is Chavo really that big of a draw down in Texas? Do they really think that by putting Chavo Guerrero in that graphic that all of the Mexicans that live in the area will see that and go, holy shit, Chavo's going to be on the show. We got to go. We got to buy tickets. Because call me crazy, but I don't think that's going to happen. I don't get this company's infatuation with making Chavo out to be some kind of legendary Hall of Famer. You know, trying to put him on the same platform as those other names just makes TNA look second rate. So, that was a bit mind-boggling to me. Taz left the announce booth about midway through the show to join the wedding party backstage. He was Bully's best man. And I don't think that's why he left the announce booth. I like to think he left in the middle of the show and then later on turned heel because of Todd Kennelly's hilariously awful comments here. As Taz was explaining that he had to go backstage and he had, you know, business to tend to and blah, 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 Kennelly turns to him. He turns to Taz and says, and I quote, he refers to him as the human best man machine. The human best man machine? I don't even know what to say to that. I know I would have turned heel too if someone had used that line on me. I blame Todd. The guy is, he's so stiff and awkward at times that it's uncomfortable. He's not a terrible announcer. And you could tell he's a wrestling fan. He's not some, you know, dummy that knows nothing about wrestling that they just brought in. That he's fine. He's okay. But I just think, at least when he's on camera, when they have the cutaways to the announcers, the dude's got to loosen up a little bit. He just always seems so stiff and just very awkward. Sting pleaded with Hulk Hogan in the ring to put his differences with Bully aside and attend his daughter's wedding. Hulk said the only thing that he could say is that he would do the right thing, brother. And then he walked off. And they played this up throughout the entire show, whether or not Hogan would be there to walk his daughter down the aisle. It paid off in the end because the fans reacted really big to it when Hogan came out in his tuxedo. So that was very cool. They showed footage from Bully's bachelor party at Rick's Cabaret here in New York City on Wednesday night. I wanted badly to go. Bully was tweeting about it all day Wednesday. He said, everybody's invited. Come down to Rick's. At 9 o'clock, I think I got out of work at 5:30. I wasn't hanging around Manhattan for 4 hours doing nothing, so I didn't go. I know Tommy Dreamer was there with him. Judging by the footage they showed on this show, it doesn't look like I missed much, so I don't feel too bad about it. Velvet Sky had a real ugly match on this show with Gail Kim, and ugly is not normally a word I associate with Velvet Sky and Gail Kim, but this match, as Jim Ross would say, bowling shoe ugly. Largely because of Velvet. There was a neckbreaker spot here that she botched real bad. I felt bad for them. In the end, Velvet won the match, so she now is the number one contender for the Knockouts title. There's something still about Velvet's face since she came back that just seems different to me. It seems off. It looks like she had to have some work done, you know, during the time off that she had. I don't know if that's the case or not, just what I think. And if she did, that's a real shame. She didn't have to go do that. Aries and Rude came to the ring to air their grievances. They also came out to object to the wedding, which was funny because you can't object to the wedding before it actually begins. And eventually the legendary grappler, Chavo Guerrero and Hernandez, came out to object. Not to the wedding. They objected to Bobby Rude and Austin Aries. and they brawled. Ares and Rude were chased away. You know, these two were obviously beneath their level, but as long as they beat them for the belts in the end, I'm fine with it. So, see if that's the direction they go in. Backstage, Hogan was in his office showing Sting a picture of Brooke as a baby. I remember that photo from somewhere, the photo of Hogan sitting Indian-style playing with Brooke. I've seen that picture somewhere. I don't remember if it was in the WWF magazine or if it was like People magazine or something back in the early 90s, but I've definitely seen that photo somewhere before, pre-internet, which I know makes me sound old to some of you, I'm sure, but believe it or not, there actually was a time where you could not just find everything you needed on the internet until Al Gore came along and created it for us, so you can thank him for that. This was a real good segment, though. Hogan was getting all sentimental and saying, you know, he's just trying to protect his daughter from the evils of the world. You know, something every dad can relate to. And Sting told him he was wrong about Bully. Hogan teased leaving the building. He said he was going to pack his stuff up and leave, but he said, when it comes to family, I always do the right thing. And I was amused by the fact that we had a cameraman secretly filming this meeting with Sting and Hogan from outside Hogan's office, through the blinds, through the windows. But meanwhile, you had a second cameraman filming this entire thing from inside the office, in plain view of Sting and Hogan. Is there a rogue cameraman in TNA? Did this guy get fired or something, and so he has to hide out in the shadows? Is he a non-union worker? What's the deal here? Finally, we had the wedding. It was time for the big ceremony here between Bully Ray and, I guess, Ms. Bully Ray, or Ms. Brooke Hogan, as she is called. Again, this the whole setup here, they took the ring ropes down, they had the flowers, they had the wedding cake, you know, the knockouts were out there dressed in blue, and Bully's extreme groomsmen were out there, Dreamer, Taz, Spike, and Brooke came to come out. Unfortunately, her dad was not there. She looked very sullen and very sad. And suddenly the crowd came alive, and there is Hulk Hogan coming out dressed up in a tuxedo, ready to walk his daughter down the aisle. Again, the fans reacted great to this. It was a nice way to kind of tease it and build it up throughout the show. And we were off to the races at that point. We had, you know, they were in the ring doing, you know, what you normally do in a wedding ceremony. They're both saying mushy stuff to each other. I don't have to go into detail here. I think you all know pretty much what this was about. And basically, the big angle came at the end when the reverend, or pastor, I guess whatever, what would he be? Priest? I don't know. I'm not big into that sort of thing. We'll call him the priest. When the priest was about to unite them and say, you know, by the power vested in me, all of a sudden Taz comes from out of nowhere, grabs a microphone out of his hand, and he says, listen, I got two questions for you. Are you sure you really want to do this? And Bully and Brooke say, yeah, we're getting married. He goes, okay, fine, you want to do this. My second question is it just me, or is it freaking hot in here? And at that point, Bully, or rather Taz, I should say, takes off his tuxedo jacket to reveal an Aces and Eights vest. And the fans all go, ooh. Fans react to that, and you can hear Hogan in the background telling Brooke to get out of the ring. He knows trouble's coming. All of a sudden, Aces and Eights descend upon the ring, and we have a big brawl, and people are getting their ass kicked. Tommy Dreamer now has the distinction of having his ass kicked by both The Shield and Aces and Eights, all within the time span of 1 month. So maybe it would be safer for Tommy to just stay home and lock the doors. Me, that's what I'm thinking. If there's one thing about this I did not like, well, let's just go through what happened here. Basically, Aces and Eights descended upon the ring. They're kicking everybody's ass. Hogan, if you go back and watch it, Hogan, there may have been somebody who swung at him, but Hogan went down very, very gently. And he had to, because if you remember when Hogan wrestled in Australia against Ric Flair a couple years back, they had that tour, it was Hogan versus Flair, Hogan's hip kept going out on him. Hogan's very fragile, I think we all are well aware at this point. So even something as simple as just falling down on his side, he has to be very careful with that because he could throw his hip out all over again, or his back, or you know, God knows what else. But everybody was laid out. Bully was laid out. Hogan was laid out. Dreamer. And Brooke was on the outside being restrained by the still nameless Mike Knox and Doc. And what happened here basically is her boob fell out. If you go back and watch, if you want, if you're into that sort of thing, You could tell that she was trying desperately to cover up her exposed breast, which just fell out of her top, basically. And it's funny because Knox and Gallows, I don't think they realized it, but she was struggling mightily to keep that boob covered up. And finally, they let her go. She went over to the side of the ring where her father was laying. She leaned in to talk to him. And Hulk is telling her, listen, go check on Bully. Don't check on me. Check on Bully. Check on your husband or your would-be husband. And if you listen in, you can hear Brooke tell her dad, my boob's out. Not once, but twice, actually. She said, my boob's out. And it looked like she was trying to get her boob back in. And finally, she did. And she went over to check on Bully. And that's how the show went off the air. So a little bit of a wardrobe malfunction there at the end. If there's one thing I did not like, it was how lifeless the commentary was once Aces and Eights invaded the ring. You had chaos and havoc, right? They're just wreaking havoc here. And I really felt like if there was ever a time for a good old-fashioned Jim Ross freak-out moment on commentary, this would have been it. This would have been so much more special if you had something like that on commentary. Even Michael Cole has had some great calls where he's, you know, been appalled by something and he's shouting and the whole deal. We didn't have that here. You know, Mike Tenay tries, but it always sounds so forced from him. And Todd Kennelly, I thought, was terrible here. I thought with this angle at the end, he was awful. You know, he's just like, Mike, what does this mean? What are we seeing? I mean, it sounded like he was, you know, just completely lifeless. You know, you would have had more emotion from a corpse. And he just did a really poor job, I felt, of getting across how heinous this all was. I'm not saying you have to just shout all the time, but again, if there was ever a moment for something like that, this would have been it. You think back to some of the famous Jim Ross calls from over the years when he just goes nuts. If something really, again, heinous and evil happens. And it just makes it feel that much more special. I think it just drives the point home that much better. We didn't get that here. So in that respect, I think this fell a little bit flat, and it's because of the announcers. Now, as far as the Taz reveal, there are a lot of arguments that can be made against this. Taz has neck problems. He can't wrestle. He's also grossly overweight for a man of his height. Why turn him heel and do this angle if there can be no payoff to it? All of those are valid points. Not disputing that. But if Taz still has one gift, if it's the gift of gab. I've said that recently I felt like Taz just was there collecting a paycheck. His commentary, quite frankly, for quite a while now, has not been what it once was. It has not been very good. You know, there was no real passion or energy behind his announcing. And I still feel that way. And no, I don't think he's been that way on purpose as part of this angle because, you know, it was all part of the master plan. Again, he's been that way for many, many months. But I still believe that deep down, when motivated, Taz can cut a real kick-ass promo. I know it didn't exactly work out having him as Samoa Joe's protege back when they did that angle years ago, but this might just be the best role for him right now. As the mouthpiece for Aces and Eights, I think he could be much better in that role than D-Von has been. And D-Von hasn't been, you know, awful, but D-Von is not Taz when it comes to promos. You know, could this be Dusty Rhodes joining the NWO all over again? Yeah, it could be. But I'm willing to give it a chance and see what role they have Taz play here. I certainly didn't see the turn coming, so they got me. I give them credit for that. I did not see that coming. Now the key is in the follow-up and how they handle it. And again, I haven't read the results yet for next week's edition of Impact, so I don't know exactly how they follow this up. I'll watch it like many of you will on Thursday night, and we'll see. But I'm willing to take a wait-and-see approach here and see where this goes. This was an interesting twist. I have not been a fan of the Aces and Eights angle at all. I'm still not a big fan of the Aces and Eights angle. But again, if they can salvage this, if they've got some big turns, if they've got some big things planned for it, this was a step in the right direction. You can't keep putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. Something has to give. You have to do something already because this thing is failing. And I saw there was a thread on, I think it was on the Solomonster Sounds Off group, page on Facebook. We have, you know, a profile page where you can friend me. We also have a fan page, which is not as active as I'd like for it to be. And there's a group page where you guys, you know, can apply for membership. I approve you. And you can just comment. You just comment and talk about whatever you want to outside of the profile page. And I believe it was on there. There was some dialogue back and forth between people about this angle. And there was one or two people saying that, you know, our opinion really doesn't matter because the Aces and Eights thing obviously is doing very well. TNA ratings are up and interest is up. And I don't know where that bullshit argument is coming from. TNA ratings have actually been down, on average, since the Aces and Eights angle started. There will be weeks like this week. Obviously, there was a big wedding angle. Typically, wedding angles do very well in wrestling. So, yeah, Impact was way up this week. But a week ago, when they expected the show would be doing very well, the show was actually down, and there was no competition. There was no, you know, football game or basketball game, or if there was, you know, the basketball game was inconsequential to Impact. It didn't really affect them too much. So, for every week that Impact goes up a little bit, the next week they're right back down. Aces and Eights has not had any real positive, noticeable impact on the Impact ratings. And as far as the overall interest in the product, I disagree with you completely on that. Aces and Eights has, if anything, you know, some weeks, it ruined the show for me. Because it's completely ludicrous to me, some of the things they do, which is completely unbelievable and unrealistic, some of the stuff they do with Aces and Eights. And there's nothing about Aces and Eights that I can really get behind. Aces and Eights are a bunch of job guys. Thank God they didn't wrestle this week, or else they probably would have lost. Again, Aces and Eights, aside from one or two matches, has lost every single match they've been in. It's like they're going out of their way to make them look like the modern-day job squad. So this notion that, well, you know, the Aces and Eights thing, it really is working because, you know, people are into it and ratings are up. I don't know where that's coming from, but that's not true. Now, can they turn that around? Yeah, maybe they could. I hope they can. We'll find out. Maybe people like the Taz turn and they tune in to find out, you know, what happens next, who the next person is to join Aces and Eights. Again, there's still Wes Briscoe and Garrett Bischoff and even Bully Ray. I still believe that in the end, Bully Ray will have something to do with Aces and Eights. I think that's where this is going. I'm like Hogan. I don't trust him. You don't go from being the biggest bully and the biggest heel in the business to being the biggest sap all within a few weeks. There's got to be more to it than that. So we'll see. We'll see where they go with it. But again, I just had to mention that this argument, this notion that Aces and Eights has been such a successful thing for TNA, it's been a positive, in our opinion, it's just a bunch of internet marks. Our opinion doesn't matter. These are facts. Show me any noticeable positive impact that the Aces and Eights storyline has had on Impact. It really hasn't. Now, for as much as I may have enjoyed Impact this week and the wedding angle, whatever goodwill they may have built up with me was taken away with this next story. Apparently, Jeff Hardy, the reigning TNA World Heavyweight Champion, mind you, biggest star in the company, certainly one of the biggest stars, will not be part of the upcoming TNA UK tour. Actually, I think they may already be on tour. And this is a big tour for them, too. They've been promoting this tour for many, many months. I think they had one last January. It was very successful. They're going to be taping 4 episodes of Impact over in the UK, which means that's 4 TV shows that the world champion will be unable to appear on. So, boy, is it not a good thing that TNA announced their pay-per-view changes, because if they had a pay-per-view coming up in February, you'd have the world champion unable to appear probably on any Impact episodes leading up to the next pay-per-view. So thankfully for them, they don't have another show until lockdown on March 10th. But Sting will be replacing Jeff Hardy in all the cities on the UK tour, which, again, I don't know if they're already on tour or the tour begins on Monday. I want to say the tour begins on Monday, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But I had one person in particular email me the other day asking me if Jeff Hardy was going to be appearing or not. He had seen an item on SEScoops.com saying that Hardy would not be there. I was a little out of the loop during the week, and so I was still under the impression Hardy would be there. I immediately went on the TNAWrestling.com website, found the news item, the main news story about the UK tour, scrolled down, and Jeff Hardy was still being advertised for the tour. And so I got back to this person. I said, as far as I know, you know, it could just be an error on SE Scoops' part. As far as I know, Hardy is still on the tour. Nope, SE Scoops was right, and I was wrong. Jeff Hardy is not going to the UK. Now, TNA is claiming, and again, spoiler alert on this, this could be construed as a little bit of a spoiler for the next edition of Impact, so skip ahead if you don't want to know. The last thing I want to do is feel the wrath of people who, you know, hate getting spoilers here. TNA will claim that it is due to Jeff Hardy being injured by Aces and Eights, and that is the reason why he is unable to go on tour in the UK. And in fact, the reality is that Jeff Hardy cannot travel to the UK because he has a felony conviction. on his record. He pled guilty to felony drug charges well over a year ago, in fact. So TNA, pretty hard for them to claim ignorance on this subject. They've been promoting Hardy for this UK tour for what, 6 months now? 8 months? 9 months? Hell, when I got that email last week, a couple days ago from the listener, I went on the TNA website and Jeff Hardy was still being advertised for the UK tour. And the reason he can't go over there is because of a felony conviction on his record that came about well over a year ago. So, again, with TNA, it's always one step forward, two steps back. Here's a pretty good edition of Impact, a very entertaining show, had a lot of nice things to say about it, and then I hear about this bullshit. You follow up a very good edition of Impact with this, you kill whatever goodwill you have with people over this. I've had a lot of people, you know, expressing their disappointment with TNA because they live over there. They're over in Europe. They're over in the UK. They were looking forward to seeing Jeff Hardy. And so, yeah, TNA trying to make good by sending Sting over there, which is a nice thing for them to do, because apparently Sting wrestled already his quote, final UK tour last year. So I guess that was his next-to-last UK tour. Sting is doing them a favor by coming and doing this tour unexpectedly. But so what? There are a lot of Jeff Hardy fans out there, especially younger Jeff Hardy fans. Sting doesn't mean that much to them. They want to see the champion. They want to see Jeff Hardy, and now they can't. Because they were led to believe when they bought tickets that he was going to be there. And apparently, TNA knew. And they still advertised him. And if they knew, they owe it to those fans, at least, again, the ones in the UK, to issue an on-air apology and fess up for their false advertising. Don't claim some injury angle bullshit. Don't post a little note on your website saying, hey, sorry, we fucked up. No, on television, the least you can do is have your announcers face the camera or have Dixie Carter face the camera and fess up for their false advertising. Because there's no excuse for that. If I were in the UK and I was looking forward to seeing somebody, if Joe Park, you know, was advertised for the UK tour, whether he was wrestling or doing a segment or whatever, you know, a law seminar, whatever it is, I'm a huge fan of Joe Park. I would probably consider buying tickets to the show just so I can see him, because I like him and I find him entertaining. And if I found out that TNA knew he was working a case in court that day and wouldn't be able to go, I'd be pretty pissed off about that. And so the people over there, they have every right to be pissed off about that. It's just such a slimy, disgusting thing on their part, if that's what happened here. And I'm reading this, and I find it incredibly difficult to believe that somebody in TNA didn't realize, hey, wait a minute, this guy is a convicted felon, basically. He's not going to be able to go over there. So why are we advertising him? Why are we claiming he's going to be there when we know he can't get over there? Maybe they tried. Maybe they were working with the government or something and trying to get to have an exception made and they failed. That still doesn't excuse it. I mean, this is really bad. I mean, this is real bullshit here on TNA's part. I don't really know any other way to put it. And like I said, they at the very least, they owe it to their fans to issue an apology on the air. Anything else to me is unacceptable. Anything else to me is a cop-out, it's bullshit, it's a slap in the face of the fans over there. And if I'm those fans over there, I'm writing into TNA nonstop, and I'm letting them know exactly how I feel about this, because they should not be treated that way. That's not right. Raw was in Houston last Monday night. Houston also happened to be the location for WrestleMania 25, which is allegedly where Hulk Hogan was to have battled John Cena in Hogan's retirement match back in 2009. TMZ broke the news earlier this week that Hogan had filed a $50 million lawsuit against the Laser Spine Institute of Florida, claiming doctors there performed numerous surgeries on his back that ended up ruining his career, and the planned match with Cena did not take place because of that. They don't specifically say it was for WrestleMania, the match, but obviously if they weren't, you know, if they were going to do that match, they weren't going to blow Hulk versus Cena on Backlash. So I think it's safe to say it would have been a WrestleMania match. And there were rumblings at that time that WWE was looking to book a Hulk Hogan versus John Cena match, and it just never materialized. That is true. That is not the normal BS that you would expect to hear from Hulk Hogan. If Hogan is to be believed, we now know why that match did not take place. I don't know how that would have impacted the Triple H Randy Orton main event at Mania 25 that year, but it would have given us a double main event of Hulk vs. Cena and Undertaker vs. Shawn Michaels, which is my favorite WrestleMania match of all time. Although I'm not exactly sure about the timeline on those surgeries, I believe that Hogan had at least one procedure done prior to his time in TNA. I believe the lawsuit mentions surgeries from February of 2009 into 2010, which is when he joined TNA. But I don't remember hearing about him having any kind of major back surgery until well after WrestleMania 25. I think he had a hip replaced and a knee replaced, but that's not what he's suing for. The $50 million figure is for what Hogan's people are calling a phase-out contract. So in other words, it would have included a Mania payday for the match with Cena, but also any other appearances that he would have made or any roles he may have played on TV, maybe a GM role, not unlike the one he now plays in TNA, for far less money, I'm sure. But all of that stuff, plus merchandising, I would imagine, all of that would have been part of the contract, or so Hogan claims. I would love to know where he got that $50 million number from. Even if the idea is to negotiate down from a very high number, it's a ridiculous amount of money. There's no way, there is not a chance he would have made that much money off any WWE contract. Even at his peak, there's no way in hell. I think that Steve Austin at his peak, in his best year, and again, Steve Austin did not have as much time on top as Hogan did. I'm sure if you look at the body of their careers and you tally up the millions of dollars they made, perhaps Hogan made more money than Austin. Wouldn't surprise me. I'm sure they're still both doing very well off residuals and royalties and such. But I believe at his peak, in his best year, which would have been 99 in WWE, supposedly, I think Austin made about $13 million or something like that, something close to that. Rock was not too far behind, I think, in his best year. Ain't no way Hogan was making $50 million. And he hasn't exactly had a great deal of success with other lawsuits he's filed recently either, like the one against Gawker for airing clips from his sex tape. That got thrown out by a judge. Hogan then refiled that suit a few weeks ago, and unfortunately for him, that case has ended up back with the original judge who rejected Hogan's claims in the first place. So I don't see that ending too well. But that makes two blockbuster matches that Hulk Hogan has tried to get and missed out on over the years. The one with Cena, and of course a match with Steve Austin, which Hogan wanted in the worst way, and Austin just wouldn't give it to him. You know, the time to do that match with Hogan and Austin really would have been WrestleMania 18 instead of Rock vs. Hogan. But supposedly it was Austin's call not to do it. But between those matches alone, the money Hulk would have made, and if he would have signed some sort of retirement contract at that point or a Legends deal with WWE, he probably would be sitting pretty right now. He'd be doing pretty well for himself. You know, even if he still went through the divorce, he'd probably be doing okay. Which is not to say that he's hurting for cash right now. He's not destitute. He's not living in a cardboard box at the end of, Hollywood Boulevard or anything like that. But he ain't worth anywhere near what he once was. Or frankly, what he should be worth right now. Hulk Hogan, with the money he probably saved up over the years and the money he made and all the endorsement deals and such. I mean, Hulk Hogan should be a multi-millionaire many times over. And I know the divorce hit him pretty hard, but he's also made a lot of boneheaded decisions. But when it comes to those two matches, it makes you wonder, you know, what might have been. Hogan versus Austin, I don't think Hogan versus Austin would have been a great wrestling match, but Rock versus Hogan wasn't a great wrestling match. It was okay, but it was the spectacle of it. Rock versus Hogan, again, when Hogan hulked up in that match, I mean, I would have given anything to be in the Sky Dome that night. The reaction he got, it was great. It was the best thing about WrestleMania 18. So who knows, if it would have been Austin Hogan instead, maybe things wouldn't have been quite as good. You know what I think, and this is just my thought, I really think, I'm sure that Austin believes, and he said this, if he was going to come back, or if he was going to have a big match like that, he takes pride in his work, he wants to go out there and have a great match, he wants to have the best match on the show, he wants to be Stone Cold Steve Austin, and nothing less. And he has said that he just didn't think he could get a good match out of Hogan. I'm sure he believes that. I'm sure that's true. I think one of Austin's fears, and if I were Austin, I'd be worried about this too, just might have been the idea that he goes out there, still as one of the biggest baby faces in the company, and one of the biggest stars in WWE history. What if I go out there and they boo me and they cheer Hogan? I think anybody you were going to trot out there in that building up in Canada that night was going to get booed out of the building no matter who they were. And in that case, it was Rock, and Rock should have been used to it already. Rock was in Steve Austin's home state of Texas the year before WrestleMania, both baby faces, right, in the main event. One of the, probably the best WrestleMania show top to bottom of all time. And Rock got booed pretty heavily by that crowd. So Rock went through essentially the same thing the following year against Hogan, and he played it perfectly. I thought Rock did very well, taking that situation and making it work. I don't know that Austin would have handled it quite as well. I think Austin might have been a little afraid. I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to get booed, and Hogan's going to get cheered, and the spotlight's going to be on him, and that's everything Steve Austin did not want. So he said, no, I don't want the match. It's probably maybe it was the right call for him to make. I don't know. But again, it makes you wonder. Two big matches like that that we could have had but didn't. And it's too bad. I'm sure Hogan feels worse about it than you and I do. Because he could have made... he could have retired off that money, off those two matches alone. Let's move on to the mailbag here. If you have questions and shout-outs for me, you could always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Matt writes in, I was wondering if I can get a shout-out. As of New Year's Eve, I am officially engaged. I popped the question to my girlfriend Ashley, and she said... yes. So congratulations to the happy couple. I hope things go better for you guys than they did for Bully Ray and Brooke this week. I also have a mailbag question from him. Matt says, I've often heard there was legitimate heat between Bobby Heenan and Tony Schiavone back in WCW. Can you explain this? Also, I was recently watching the Sting Flair match from the Final Nitro in 2001 and noticed that Heenan was no longer on commentary. I always thought he stayed with the company to the bitter end. When and why did he leave WCW? Well, first, Heenan never liked Schiavone, and they rarely, if ever, interacted off the air. You know, Heenan used to do a lot of radio interviews, and he would get asked about Schiavone, and he would rag on him all the time. Heenan once told the story of sitting at a bar, maybe it was after a show somewhere, and Schiavone was sitting on the opposite side of the bar right across from him, and he wouldn't even make eye contact with Heenan. I think he was intimidated by Bobby. You know, Heenan... again, when he would do those radio interviews back before he got sick, and whenever they would bring up this heat with Tony Schiavone or even just mention Schiavone's name, Heenan would pause for a moment and he'd flush the toilet. You would hear the toilet flushing in the background. Not unlike whenever Noah Mark flushes someone from the show when we do SE Scoops Live. You know, the main reason for the dislike between the two of them that I can gather is that Schiavone was looked at as a bit of a politician. You know, he would hide match finishes from the other announcers. You know, not just Bobby. I mean, he would do the same thing to Mike Tenay or, you know, whoever else he may have been working with. I'm not sure why he would do that, but he would. You know, there was no camaraderie there. There's also the Monsoon incident, and I'm not sure if Tony has ever been asked about this or if he's ever disputed it or denied it, but when Gorilla Monsoon died in 1999... and he and Heenan were best of friends. I mean, Heenan reveres, to this day, I mean, he reveres Gorilla Monsoon. Even though Monsoon never worked a day in his life for WCW, the company allowed Heenan, who was working for them at the time, to say a few words on the air at the beginning of Nitro that night about his friend. You know, it was really emotional because Heenan was fighting back tears. I mean, you could tell this guy was just all torn apart inside. And he's out there giving his friend a beautiful little eulogy on the air. And then if you watch the segment on YouTube, and it is up there on YouTube, Schiavone says something, says a few words, and then he immediately goes into announcer mode. Like, okay, now that that's out of the way, tonight on the broadcast. So, I mean, supposedly he was against the idea of even mentioning Monsoon on the show, which I don't understand why he would be, but that is the rumor, that is the belief. Heenan hated him for that. Absolutely hated him for it. And again, why Schiavone would care one way or another is beyond me. Maybe he had heat with Monsoon from his brief stint in WWF, but I never heard anything about that. Just a real dick move on his part, if that's true. And as far as when Heenan left WCW, he actually got released several months before the Final Nitro, so that would have been late 2000 when he got released from the company. The writing was on the wall. I mean, they were phasing him out more and more. He had been gone from the Nitro show for a long time already. Then they removed him from Thunder. All he had left was that frickin' Worldwide show, which is like WWE's Main Event show now. Actually, I can't even say that. At least Main Event features a big match here and there. It was beneath Main Event. I think back to how Heenan was used in WCW, and it just makes me shake my head. I mean, he was never as good in WCW, in my opinion, as he was in the WWF. And part of that may have just been his fault. You know? I mean, I'm not saying he's completely innocent in all this. If he wasn't motivated, if he didn't like being there, if he was just there to collect a paycheck, like Taz, I feel like sometimes would sound like on commentary in TNA, that's on Bobby. But a lot of it was just in how he was used or how he was not used. Or the way they had him calling the action on Nitro like a straight man instead of being a true color commentator, which is what the role he was best suited for. It seemed like he wasn't allowed to do his shtick, and it was never the same. Just completely mind-boggling the way he was treated in WCW. Ed in Kansas writes in, been a listener since episode 27, is Royal Rumble season, and I have been watching a marathon of old Rumble matches, as is tradition. I had a question about the end of the 1997 Rumble when Austin was eliminated and then came back into the ring to win. Bret Hart was noticeably very upset and directed his anger at Vince McMahon, who was commentating. I was wondering if this was all the original plan for Austin to win that way, or did something go wrong? The finish of the 1997 Rumble was very much planned that way. It was also part of a longer-term storyline to turn Bret Hart heel. Really, it started the previous month after Shawn Michaels accidentally cost Bret the title. Bret was wrestling Psycho Sid trying to win the belt. This was about a month after Bret had come back from his hiatus and re-signed that 20-year contract with the company. And Michaels inadvertently cost Bret the title in that match. And after the match, Bret beat the crap out of Michaels. I mean, he just beat the shit out of him on the outside of the ring, pulled Shawn's shirt over his head like a hockey player, and just went to town on him. And he was just beating on him out of frustration. Later on, he talked about getting screwed. And that became his gimmick in a way going forward. He got screwed at the Rumble. In fact, he quit the very next night on Raw. He came out and he quit. Now, he did end up coming back. I think at the end of the show, actually, he came back. But he talked about getting screwed, right, at the Rumble. Got screwed out of the title by Steve Austin the next month. He got screwed out of the title in a cage match against Sid, which is where the infamous profanity-laced tirade on Raw took place. One of my all-time favorite Raw moments. And, of course, the big screw job, which was not planned, at least not by him, that came later in the year. So 1997, the end of 96 into 97, that whole year, when it came to Bret Hart, it was all about Bret Hart getting screwed. He didn't just get screwed in Montreal, people. Go back and watch TV at the beginning of the year. He was coming out quite often and talking about being screwed. So that's where that comes from. Jamie writes in, I'd like to get a shout-out for my birthday on January 23rd. I'm a longtime listener, and you're podcast is the reason I still watch the product. I noticed on Raw during his TLC match with Punk that Ryback started to show some personality, asking the crowd if they wanted him to suplex Punk on the chair or on the ladder. What do you think about this, and what does Ryback have to do to survive being a main eventer? Ryback should interact more with the audience. You know, I think that's a good thing. As far as staying a main eventer, I assume that's what you mean by survive. Just keep trying to evolve the character. Don't be one-dimensional. You know, the fans are going to get tired with that stuff real quick. That means working on your promo skills. That means being more interactive with the fans. It means coming up with some new power moves. You know, all of those things Ryback can do to stay fresh. Part of it also is out of his control. I mean, let's be honest here. It's up to WWE who they want to push. Ryback got hot at a bad time in that they couldn't take the title off Punk, right, and end his reign prematurely. I think were it not for that, they absolutely would have put the title on Ryback. Ryback would have already been the WWE champion were it not for CM Punk's title reign. It's not his fault. He just has to hope that he doesn't get lost in the shuffle. And the best way to do that is to stand out and dare to be a little bit different. Don't get stagnant. John Cena can get away with that because he's the number one guy. He can wear the same stuff and cut the same corny promos and all that every single week. And his spot is pretty much safe. Everybody else, they don't have that luxury. Ryback is not John Cena. Cliff writes in, why was it good enough for guys like Rey Mysterio, Chris Jericho, and CM Punk to keep their names when they entered WWE, but names like Claudio Castagnoli, Tyler Black, and Chris Hero are not good enough to keep? For big stars at the time, like Mysterio and Jericho, it would have been I mean, it would have been completely foolish to change their names. You know, why do you think guys like Booker T and DDP kept their names during the invasion? Now, for lesser-known talent, it's more of a right place, right time kind of thing. You know, the only reason Punk kept his name is because of Paul Heyman. Back when he was involved in developmental, Paul Heyman fought tooth and nail for Punk to be able to keep that name. Who's fighting for these guys today? Heyman never cared if he rocked the boat. He and Vince used to clash constantly. They would fight all the time when he was on the writing team. They need somebody with brass balls, or at least someone high enough up in the hierarchy who can stick up for these guys and not worry about jeopardizing their own job. And I guess, unfortunately, that's just not the case. Mario from Chicago writes in, wanted to get a shout-out from me and my girlfriend Lupe D'Ortiz. My question for you is, has WWE banned the powerbomb? I've always liked it as a finisher, but don't see it getting used anymore. Really? Because there's these three guys in flak jackets who keep running out every week triple-team powerbombing people, in case you didn't notice. And I'm pretty sure I've seen a powerbomb or two used here and there on WWE TV recently. I just can't remember by who. You know, it's not being used as a finisher, if that's what you're really referring to. That is true, but as far as I know, I don't believe it's been banned. Joe from Trenton, New Jersey writes in, longtime listener, if you had a choice as to which title you wanted to win in WWE out of the Intercontinental or the United States Championship, which one would be the one you would want to have and why? And which one do you think has the better history? Well, growing up as a WWE fan, I loved the Intercontinental title. I loved the look of the physical belt. I loved the people who used to wrestle for it, like Don Morocco and Randy Savage, Ricky Steamboat, Rick Rude, Mr. Perfect, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels. So, of the two, I would rather have been the IC champion. As far as which one has the better history, I'm not really sure what you mean by that. The NWA United States Championship, which is what it was when it was created, right? It was an NWA title. That championship dates back to 1975. And there have been 77 different champions, okay, right up until Antonio Cesaro. If you count this as one long lineage, and a lot of people don't do that because they figure, okay, once WCW went out of business, that ended the chain, but some people still, like WWE, for example, they consider this an extension of the U.S. title from WCW and the NWA. So, again, there have been 77 different champions since 1975. I had to look this up. I did not know this offhand. The Intercontinental title dates back to 1979, which that I already did know. Pat Patterson was given the title after winning an imaginary tournament in Rio de Janeiro, which they still joke about, by the way, on TV. Every now and then they joke about the supposed tournament in Rio. That never happened. So the Intercontinental title was created a couple of years after the U.S. title. There have been a total of 70 different champions, so seven fewer. So in that respect, I'd have to say the U.S. title has a richer history than the Intercontinental title. A lot of Hall of Famers have held the U.S. title. Harley Race, Ric Flair has held it a whole bunch of times, Dusty Rhodes, Lex Luger. And you know, the same can be said for the Intercontinental title as well. Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Randy Savage, Triple H, Kane, Edge. So both have had their own prestigious history, but again, as a biased WWE fan in that respect, I'd go with the IC strap. Kane Corey writes in, over the past few months, I've noticed an increase in people who continually hate on indie wrestlers. I'm sure it has been going on longer than that. But on SE Scoops, I read all these idiotic and ridiculous comments these indie haters are leaving, especially on your most recent Sound Off post calling you an indie fanboy. All I really want to know is, why do people have so much hate for indie wrestlers? I have never really understood why, and would love your opinion. I find that comment about me being an indie fanboy especially humorous, given how many indie reviews I typically do on my show. That is, I don't do many. You know, it's just a bunch of very insecure people with mommy issues. They see people who enjoy something that they themselves are not familiar with, or something they just don't like, and they feel the need to belittle and berate and bully people for it. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a lot of keyboard courage. See, these people need to be a star. That's what they need to do. They have to be a star. They have to show respect and tolerance. They'd be better off for it. One of our good friends, Barry Wright, or Dan Barone, as he was known when he got squashed on SmackDown by Ryback last year, Barry writes into the sound off and mentions that TNA is having a thing called the Gut Check Challenge, which will be like a tournament where fans can vote on who will be the next wrestler to appear in a Gut Check segment on TV. Well, I am one of the participants in the contest, and I would be so grateful if people could vote for me. I just received an email from TNA asking for a photo of me, saying that I would be in the contest. And indeed, voting opened, I believe, yesterday morning. That would be Saturday morning. So you can visit ImpactWrestling.com right now and vote for Barry in the Gut Check Challenge. Apparently, it's a collection of wrestlers that have participated in Gut Checks at live events across the country who did not make it. And the fans here have a chance to vote one person who previously lost to get another chance, this time on TV. So if you have a moment, take the time to vote for Barry. He's good people. And while we're on the subject of voting, I just want to mention this again, that many of you have been kind enough to nominate me for a Shorty Award in the category of Best Podcaster in the 2013 Shorty Awards. And voting ends on February 10th. You can go to shortyawards.com/Solomonster. And apparently there they have a little box. You can tweet your vote, which is a requirement. So if you don't have Twitter, I guess you'll have to make an account. But you can tweet your vote for me. And again, the Pokemon person, the My Little Pony person, among others, are ahead of me on this list. I don't even care where I end up. I don't care if I win. I just want to beat the Pokemon dude. Like, it's just a matter of personal pride for me. I will be forever shamed if somehow he manages to beat me. I know there's a lot of very, very, very hardcore Pokemon fans out there. Is Pokemon still a thing? I mean, I remember when it was really popular, you know, years and years ago. I know they still have probably cartoons on Saturday morning and all that, but is that really still a thing? I thought Pokemon was a fad that came and went, but maybe I'm wrong. So if you want to take a second to vote for me, feel free. Again, shortyawards.com/Solomonster. So that's going to do it for episode 256. I want to thank you all for listening. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. You can friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSolomonster. Don't forget we have a YouTube channel as well, where I will be posting additional episodes of The Sound Off from way back when in 2007. If you want to listen to the first six episodes of The Sound Off from November and December of 2007, the only way you can do that, unless you are one of the original fans who still has it saved, is by going on my YouTube channel. My username on there is TheSolomonster, all one word. Very original, I know. And you will find those episodes there. I will be posting episodes 7 and others in the future. I don't know when, so you can subscribe to me on there. And when new videos go up, you will be alerted. Same thing with iTunes. You can subscribe to this podcast for free in iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. And anytime a new episode is posted, you will be the first to receive it. It will be automatically downloaded for you on your computer, on your mobile device. You can leave a review for the show in iTunes as well, which is always helpful. And I think that covers all the important stuff. So, again, thank you for tuning into episode 256 this week. I very much appreciate it. Next weekend is Royal Rumble weekend, and I don't know when the show will go up. Probably normal time on Sunday. I will be watching the Rumble elsewhere at a friend's place. And I will do my very best to get the show up as early as I can. I'll have Royal Rumble predictions next week. We'll go through the show. We'll talk about Rock vs. Punk, the 30-man Rumble match, and we'll talk about who may end up on top and all that. And if you have thoughts as well, by the way, this week, if you want to send me your predictions and thoughts on the Rumble, feel free to email them to me as well. So we'll do that next weekend. Till then, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you right back here next week on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella. This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.